Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why are college kids so fond of boozing it up, even when they experience repeated negative consequences in the form of hangovers and humiliation, to say nothing of bad grades and truly dangerous behavior? Students at many U.S. universities are famous for their embrace of alcohol. But as my guest today has learned, traditional efforts to curb excessive drinking by preaching abstinence for those under the legal age tend to fall short of their goals and don't give students the tools they need to ensure that drinking doesn't become a life-threatening activity. Thomas van der Ven is associate professor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at Ohio University. He surveyed hundreds of students at three very different universities for his new book, Getting Wasted: Why College Students Drink So Much and Party So Hard. Tom, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
So this phenomenon is evident on many college campuses, if not ubiquitous. Why has it not been studied from an academic perspective?
Well, actually, it has been studied from an academic perspective. My study is a little different, though. The large body of literature on college drinking has been produced mostly by survey researchers. So they've asked individuals to talk about how much they drink and when they started drinking and how it has affected their schoolwork and what are the different consequences. So it's been very individual, very much focused on the individual. What's different about what I've done is, as a sociologist, I think of college drinking as a group activity and as a social process. So I asked them to talk about their recent drinking episodes, who they were with, how they drank, did they feel pressure to do it, why they drank, did anything go wrong, and if so, how did they work together to repair the situation? And I saw some of the stuff play out in real life, too, because I did field work in bars and street festivals and house parties and that kind of thing. So it has been studied academically, but I think mine is the first real sociological look at drinking culture.
So are there behaviors more influenced by what their peers are doing than by, say, their family background or their faith tradition?
Well, I would say that when they arrive at college, they already have a predisposition. Mm-hmm. So that one of the best predictors of being a heavy drinker in college is being a heavy drinker in high school. So a lot of college students arrive with those behaviors. And so the other, you know, if you want to talk about what predicts an abstainer, people who don't drink in college, well, they're people who didn't drink in high school. They tend to be more religious. They tend to have parents who don't drink, and especially if their mother was an abstainer. So those family factors all definitely matter.
It's interesting that you found an increase in the number of abstainers, but also in the number of binge drinkers. What do you think accounts for that?
I don't know. That's a good question. I think that, and what's interesting is that the average binge drinking averages have stayed pretty constant across the nation. So how we measure binge drinking, there's about 45% of all of college students can be categorized as binge drinkers. Why do we have those at the tail ends where we have more heavy drinkers and then the more abstainers? The abstainers, you know, that may be the result of prevention efforts at, you know, maybe the high school level.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the Monitoring the Future data, which, you know, addresses drug and alcohol use among young people, you've seen some interesting trends over time. And what we do know about young people is that one of the best ways to get them to abstain or to not take part in these high-risk activities is to convince them that it will hurt their health.
Mm-hmm.
So to tell them, you know, don't go along with the crowd, don't be a conformist, you know, to try to appeal to them that, you know, drinking is not fun or they shouldn't go along with the crowd usually doesn't work. But if you can convince them that it's a health issue, then so that may account for the more abstainers we have out there.
So binge drinking is defined as five or more drinks for a young man in college and four or more for a young woman. So these are amounts that get them very drunk.
Yeah. A lot of students would have a problem with that.
What do you mean?
They would say, "Well, I drink way more than five, or I drink way more than four," and they don't understand why that why it's defined at that level. So, for some, you know, it depends on how fast did they consume it, what is their body weight. It depends, you know, are they eating on a full stomach or an empty stomach? All those kinds of things affect one's blood alcohol concentration.
So let's talk about this. What did you learn about what students see as the benefits of heavy drinking?
If I had to, you know, create a top five list, at number one, I would put the lowering of inhibitions.
Mm-hmm.
They talk about alcohol giving them sort of a more carefree attitude. They don't worry so much about what their social audiences think. They have more confidence. A lot of them talk about being shy, and normally, and that alcohol allows them to talk to people that they wouldn't normally talk to approach a romantic or, you know, sexual interest, somebody that they would like to meet and get to know. That alcohol allows them to do that because they're too shy normally. So there's that. And because you've got all these people hanging out together, interacting with their inhibitions down, it creates this world of adventure, sort of where anything can happen. And they're having fun together. They're laughing. They feel more emboldened to dance and sing and just to take risks and just sort of have fun. So I think that world is a interesting place to visit. If you think of collective intoxication as a place, it's sort of an interesting place to visit where you meet people and helps you to hook up and those kinds of things. So those are important reasons why.
And you found in some cases that students see partying as an important part of their identity.
Yeah, definitely. This is important because we're talking about 18, 19, 20-year-olds when they get to college, and this is what we call emerging adulthood, so it's in between adolescence and full-blown adulthood. It's a time when young people are looking for an identity. They're who am I? What kind of person am I? What am I going to do with my life? How do I want others to see me? The identity is the intersection between, you know, what I claim to be and what my social audience sees me to be. So identity is a very social phenomenon. But drinker is that. There are people out there who that's their identity. That's how people see them. They have a reputation as being a crazy partier or somebody fun to hang out with, somebody who can drink a lot. There are different identities you can have. There's another one out there where there's a certain type of college student who is a very heavy drinker and does very well in school.
Mm-hmm.
And they have sort of a heroic air about them. I think being a heavy drinker could be somebody's identity.
And even the idea, you know, most adults, when they think about being hungover, it's just something you want to avoid at all costs. But if you're doing it with five of your best friends, then it's kind of fun.
Yeah, that came through in the data. People, a lot of the negative experiences related to heavy drinking are redefined and recast in more positive ways. So feeling hungover and sick is, I think, you know, universally agreed upon as a bad experience. So who wants to feel that way? But when I talk to the students, they often talked about being hungover the next morning as funny.
Mm-hmm.
So they're all kind of hanging out together and just holding their heads and, oh, I feel awful. I can't believe I did that. And it becomes humorous. And they went through this together. So normally when people are sick, it's a very solitary activity. But, you know, you've got four or five people who woke up together that went through this, and they start telling war stories about the night before, spend the day sort of drinking water and just trying to get through the sickness and all that. So it's a shared experience that sort of makes it a more positive one than a hangover would normally be. So, yeah.
And if they've done something embarrassing, is it like sort of universally agreed that you get a pass if you can prove that you were drunk enough?
Yeah, I think so. Some people start to wear that pass out.
Mm-hmm.
So normally people who are heavily involved in the drinking scene have a group of people that they do most of their drinking with, that they go out with and hang out with. And we've called that a drinking family, and drinking family has different roles than the people who take care of each other. One of the things that'll happen is somebody will say, "Oh, I was an idiot last night. That was so embarrassing. I can't believe I said and did that." Your friends, the people you hang out with, are likely to say, "Don't worry about it. You were hilarious."
Hmm.
Which is, it's nice. I mean, we like to surround ourselves with people who will, you know, sort of care about us unconditionally and prop us up. But maybe that facilitates the behavior too.
You get attention for having been hilarious.
Right. Right. Exactly. And people say, "Oh, you were hilarious." And part of the reason why they give you that pass is because they're, you know, it's sort of a social contract. They're hoping to get that pass from you down the road. They may need that. They may have embarrassed themselves and they need you to prop them up. But I said that it does wear thin. There are people who are considered bad drunks and their friends get sick of babysitting them.
Mm-hmm.
Bailing them out of trouble and having to follow them around and repair all the damage, you know, do damage control for them. So that happens too.
So if they're out drinking in a group, do they all sort of assume that they will, that friends will swoop in if they get into a fight or if they get into an unwanted sexual experience or something?
I think some do. I had a respondent that says she just will not get intoxicated unless she's with a couple of really close friends that she knows will do those things for her.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how aware they are of it. Like, I don't know if they say, "I'm going to go out and get hammered tonight, and I'm going to do it because I know that they'll take care of me and they'll bail me out of trouble." I don't know how conscious it is, but the stories that I collected, the interviews that I did, and the observations I made in the field suggest that this is very common activity. So sometimes I would ask them about the support that they give to each other, and it would be sort of a revelation to them.
Hmm.
It would be, "Oh, yeah, that's true. We do that. And this is my one friend is the nurturer and helps me when I'm crying and upset about a relationship. My other friend makes sure that if I'm talking to some guy and I'm too drunk." Yeah. So that they're aware of this stuff, definitely. And there's a good and a bad side to all the support.
I know that you are significantly older than the students that you're interviewing. Was it hard to get them to open up to you? Were they happy to talk about what they had done with you, who, as a professor, would be an authority figure, even if you're not their professor?
Yeah. I think that they love to talk about the drinking scene.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they're involved in it or not, they had strong opinions about it. It makes sense. They're living in this world of college drinking. I think they did open up to me. I didn't interview students that I had in class. I wanted to talk to people who didn't know me and didn't feel like who felt they could be open.
Yeah.
I think they were real open with me. And when I was in the field, I'd say that was the time when people were most sort of suspicious. Who is this guy?
At a bar or at a party or something?
Yeah, especially at a house party or at a street festival. Like, who is this old guy lurking around here? I generally had students of mine who would help me to get into that scene,
mm-hmm.
and who would vouch for me and say, "This is my professor. He's cool. Don't worry about it. He's just observing it. He's okay."
Yeah. Thomas van der Ven is my guest. He's associate professor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at Ohio University. His new book is called Getting Wasted, Why College Students Drink Too Much and Party So Hard. You can join our conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Thomas van der Ven. He's associate professor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at Ohio University and author of the new book, Getting Wasted, Why College Students Drink Too Much and Party So Hard. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. Tom, I'm curious about the perceived social consequence of not drinking. So in other words, if you are nursing a Sprite while your friends are on their seventh beer, are you still welcome at the party?
Yeah, I'm sure there's a literature on that, and I'm not real aware of it. I can talk about my own experiences here at Ohio University. Most students tell me that they don't feel a lot of pressure, that people aren't critical of them, and this is me talking to abstainers, people mm-hmm. who are drinking a Sprite at a party. They don't feel that kind of pressure to drink, and that they have to drink in order to fit in. But what I think non-drinkers do experience is just a sort of an alienation from the social scene. In other words, they can feel like they're not fully part of it. And if they're not drinkers, there are secondary effects of heavy drinking. Mm-hmm. So heavy drinkers, you know, if they get sick and they break things and they're loud and they're up late. So if you're a non-drinker and you're living in the dorm and there's a bunch of people carrying on like that, it affects your quality of life.
It's not that funny when you're sober.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think some universities have retention problems if students are out of control, and some of the, you know, real serious students who don't want to, you know, take part in that behavior are affected by the behavior of heavy drinking students. So I see that as a problem with abstainers. As far as being pressured to drink, I think it's more subtle than that, probably.
Mm-hmm. So talk about how students plan their drinking, because I was really interested to read that some of them define responsible drinking not as stopping at two beers, but as making sure they don't have class the next day if they're going to go out and get wasted.
Right. Some of them are very systematic about it, so that I had a respondent who said that she and her roommates sort of had a, you know, house meeting and decided that none of them had class on Wednesday. Hmm. So Tuesday was going to be their heavy drinking night. And so they're finding ways to, you know, to attend to their academic obligations and to be fully invested in the party scene, but they're just going to drink heavily on a night where they don't have to go to class the next day. So some of that planning is taking place.
And the reasons, the sort of occasions for drinking, it can be pretty much anything from I got a new pair of shoes to it's Thursday or, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. That was one of the questions. When I gathered the drinking story data, I asked them, tell me about the last time you drank to intoxication. And when the advantage of that is I was asking them, I was standardizing responses, so they were telling me about the last time they got drunk. They weren't telling me about the funnest time or the worst time or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then I would have them prompts, and one of them was, why did you drink on this occasion? Why did you decide to drink on this occasion? And I got the feeling that nobody had ever asked them that before. It was an odd question. And, yeah, you're right. Because it's Thursday is a response. Because I'm in college.
Yeah.
And like you said, because I got a new pair of shoes, good enough.
I know one thing that really concerns you is the ritual of the 21st birthday. And there are lots of occasions for college students to drink far too much. But this one, there's a shocking number of promising young kids who end up, you know, dying of alcohol poisoning when they turn 21.
Right. Yeah, if you look at some of the tragic stories about college drinking related fatalities, you'll see it's connected to birthday celebrations often, and 21st birthday celebrations. And there seems to be this sort of cultural mandate for young people to get the 21-year-old severely intoxicated.
Mm-hmm.
And the 21-year-old will often buy into it too. And I had respondents who said, I didn't want to get really blackout and drunk and sick, but it was my 21st birthday and my friends wanted to do that for me, so I did it.
Hmm.
They're buying into that, and that worries me. I think there are things that universities can do, partnerships with bars, and work on trying to do something about that culture, trying to not get the 21-year-old just automatically just dangerously intoxicated.
And you think even letting students know that a shot, a succession of shots can be, although they have the same amount of alcohol as a succession of beers or glasses of wine, they can work faster before anyone realizes how dangerous the situation is.
Yeah, that's right. Again, in a lot of the tragic stories, you'll see that it was just multiple shots in a very short period of time. So, I mean, there are things like an online education program. It's called Alcohol.edu.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of universities are using it for their first-year students. In fact, here at Ohio University, as a first-year student, you have to go through this. And it talks about monitoring your intake, knowing how much alcohol is in your drink. It seems sort of obvious, but people don't. Knowing how to manage your blood alcohol concentration as far as eating before and during the drinking process.
Now, do they go through these things and come away, pardon the pun, it's unintentional, sobered? Or are they snickering through the whole thing and thinking, well, what a bunch of dopes are going to believe this?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. And that's an empirical question, and that would make a good study, and maybe it's already out there. I do know that some people are responsive to this, and I think it depends on how you deliver it to them. You don't want to be totally paternalistic and treat college students like children and scold them. But I think you're on to something. I think there are some people that are just like, yeah, right, I just have to do this. It depends on how the message is delivered. I can tell you my own daughter is going to be a freshman in college this year.
Mm-hmm.
She took Alcohol.edu. She had to register, and we had a long talk about it, and I think she learned something from it. I think she felt like it was too long and all that, but I think she definitely learned something. So I think it's mixed.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go first on the phones to Brian in Dallas. Hi, Brian.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
I like your show.
Thanks.
Your guest got me thinking about the social constructs that set themselves up. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about whether he noticed a difference in the roles that are set up between male groups of drinkers and female groups of drinkers. And also, whether or not he talked to people in the aftermath of a drinking night, because I've noticed that if the social structure that is set up, like the caregiver and different roles like that, if they maintain themselves throughout the night of drinking, then it is, quote, a good drinking night. Whereas if one of those roles breaks down, then it often is a bad drinking night, no matter how you're feeling the next morning. And I'll take your answer off air.
Thanks for your call. What do you think, Tom?
That was a great sociological question. Okay, so the idea that that it may be gendered, that male groups and female groups may behave differently. I would say that the term that I use is drunk support, and drunk support is the actual or perceived delivery of provisions and care from one person to an intoxicated other during a drinking episode. I would say that it is gendered so that females are more likely to nurture, to take care of their friends when they're sick. I don't know if you've heard the phrase, holding their hair.
Yeah.
When they're throwing up, helping them when they're sick, helping them if they're upset about a relationship, that sort of thing. Males are more likely, the support that they provide would be more sort of, I've got your back.
Mm-hmm.
If a fight starts to evolve in males stepping in to help their friends in physical altercations, and then maybe bailing each other out of jail and that sort of thing. The other thing that males do is step in and help their female friends if they believe that they are at risk for sexual victimization. So if I see my female friend, she's talking and she's intoxicated and she's talking to some guy I don't know, or I think she doesn't know him, they start to leave the bar of the party, I might go over there and say, you know, this is not a good idea. Males and females do that for their friends. And I think they're already doing this, and I think it's so important for us to try to facilitate this informal support, encourage them to do that and look out for each other in that way.
And one of the things you think is important is teaching the symptoms of alcohol poisoning.
Yeah, exactly. Red Watch Band is a group that started at SUNY Stony Brook. You can find them on the internet, but they're training students in CPR, and they're training them to recognize signs of being dangerously intoxicated. I think all students should get that sort of training. Here's a simple thing that a college student should know, or anybody should know. If your friend is blackout drunk and or falling asleep and unresponsive,
mm-hmm.
Putting them to bed is a bad idea.
Hmm.
And so if you hear some of these tragedies about people dying of alcohol poisoning, you know, aspirating their own vomit, something like that, you know, that's what happens. Sometimes somebody's just, oh, they're really intoxicated, they're out of it, let's just put them to bed and go on about our business. Teaching people to recognize the signs of dangerous intoxication, teaching and making them feel responsible and confident that they can do something about it, like call 911, get involved in those ways.
Is it important to have amnesty for students who report a fellow student in trouble?
I think the data are mixed on that, whether or not that matters. I know that, I think, speaking of Red Watch Band, I think that they don't have amnesty at Stony Brook, and it hasn't hurt. I'm not 100% about that, but again, the results are mixed on whether amnesty matters.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Robert in Dallas. Hello, Robert.
Hi. I think this is a great topic, by the way, and your previous caller was excellent. I don't know if my question's that good. But coming from kind of a more of a clinical psychology perspective, I was thinking it seems to me a lot of kind of chronic heavy drinkers really have a need for you to participate, because if you don't, the juxtaposition of your abstinence from their heavy drinking really kind of almost shames implicitly without really saying anything. And I think that's why you see a lot of encouragement of, oh, yeah, come on, let's get totally blackout drunk on your 21st birthday and do all these things that are really dangerous, because there's, if I don't, it makes you embarrassed underneath all of that bravado.
Hmm. What do you think, Tom?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. And I think that's why there is a lot of encouraging of this behavior, sort of like what I said before. If you will excuse my embarrassing, you know, boorish behavior, then I will excuse yours. If I'm totally, you know, sort of an out of control, rude, belligerent, bad drunk, and then, you know, I will give you positive reflected appraisals when you act that way. You're right. It makes me look at I look better. Or I don't want you to appear to be more civilized and more under control than I am. So I think there is that social effect. I hear what you're saying.
Does the legal drinking age mean anything to anyone besides the cops?
Not in my experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't. It doesn't make a difference. In my 7 years of research, I never once heard anybody say that they had trouble getting alcohol.
I'm also curious about how the Greek system plays into heavy drinking. Is that just a fallacy that students are in sororities and fraternities are encouraged to drink more than their classmates across the hall who are independent?
Well, if you look at the survey data, one of the predictors of heavy drinking is being involved in a Greek organization. But
you think that's about the social nature of the organization, maybe?
Well, or maybe there's some self-selection.
Uh-huh.
You know, people who are drawn to Greek life are people who the party scene is important to them. So that's what I think about most heavy drinkers in college period, they came to college with, we already talked about that, with that predisposition. So I think that's true of Greek organizations too. I think they probably facilitate and encourage heavy drinking, but I think a lot of people are drawn to those places because they like to or want to party. But, you know, it's not just a Greek thing. It's happening in the dorms, and it's happening off campus, and it's pervasive.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Marshall in Fort Worth. Hi, Marshall.
Hello, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
I had a point to make and a question to ask. I started drinking when I was like 12 or 13 and caused lots of problems. Hadn't drank anything in about 13 years now. I'm almost 40. And I have heard that the older a person or kid is when they start drinking, the less likely they are to abuse it. Is there any merit to that? I'll take my question off there.
Thanks for your call. What do you know about that?
Great. Thanks for the call, and congratulations on your recovery. And I think that, you know, there's some truth to that. If you look at the data, people who drink early in life, early adolescents, are prone to be abusers later on. That's true. I mean, I think, you know, I'm not very confident in abstinence programs in college. But I think for younger kids, I think you encourage them not to drink and do what you can to keep them from getting heavily involved in the drinking scene. That is going to be the best way to keep them from being abusers later on.
Thomas van der Ven is my guest. He's associate professor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at Ohio University. We're spending this hour talking about his new book, Getting Wasted, Why College Students Drink Too Much and Party So Hard. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Thomas van der Ven. He's associate professor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at Ohio University. His new book is called Getting Wasted, Why College Students Drink Too Much and Party So Hard. Tom, I know there's not a lot about this in the book, but as a parent, I have to ask you, what impact can we have on our kids? And I'm sure that this is relevant for you as your daughter's about to go off to college. Before they go, is there any magic thing we can say to them to keep them from potentially hurting themselves?
Well, you know, the research has come out recently that suggests that it really helps when parents talk to their kids before they go away to college. So just talking to them about it is the first thing we all need to do. The things to say to them are, you know, similar to some of the things that they'll learn in something like Alcohol EDU. I personally don't think telling a kid who's going away to college to not drink makes much sense.
Mm-hmm.
Letting them know that there are those dangers out there. Letting them know that that people do die from this, that there are all kinds of injuries and health problems related to it. The risk for sexual victimization is huge.
Yeah.
Telling both our male and female children that this is happening in the drinking scene and that you need to look out for each other,
mm-hmm.
and not get yourself in those situations. Try not to, you know, make yourself vulnerable to predators, and that's not to blame the victim. That's to let people understand that there are predators out there and to be aware of them and to take care of each other. So those kinds of those are the kinds of discussions that we can have with our kids. But it also encouraged them to find an academic discipline that fascinates them and inspires them, and that college is not just about, you know, socializing and partying. It's about falling in love with a major and getting training towards your career, and emphasizing that part of college as well.
Do they, do college students, undergrads, have too much free time?
Yes.
I remember this from my own days, being really shocked that after being in school for 7 hours a day, suddenly I had like 3 hours a day of classes.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think so. That's, you know, I say that in the book, and you know, to me the strength of this book and why I think most people who went to college or are in college will appreciate it is the stories, the rich stories. And the voices of the students. So the book, the star of the book is the student and what he or she says about drinking in college. But one of the things that they say, you know, is that they don't have these social institutional bonds to keep them from drinking. So, you know, most of us who are adults and have jobs that we care about and have families and, you know, things, that we have a stake in conformity.
Right.
You can't get drunk all the time. You just couldn't accomplish. I mean, there are functional alcoholics, certainly, but there are, you know, we've got too much to do, too many people relying on us and all that. Well, your point about them having too much time in their hand, yeah, college students, I mean, they tend not to, most undergraduates, they tend not to have families of their own. They tend not to have jobs or careers that they care about. They're still financially dependent on parents, many of them. Not all, but many. And so, yeah, they lack that stake and conformity. They have all that free time. And maybe college is too easy. How do you, some of my respondents get pretty intoxicated four times a week. So how do you do that and still do well in school?
Yeah.
You know, maybe is it grade inflation? Is it we're not asking enough of our students? Is it that they can not go to class and still do well? So, yeah, I really think there's something to that.
Let's go back to the phones now. Our number 1-800-933-5372. We'll speak this time with Monica in Grapevine. Hey, Monica.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
So going back to what we were talking about just a minute ago, I just wanted to see if there was any prevalence of alcoholism among students that drank a lot during college, because I mean, when I was in college, we would go out and drink or whatever during the weekend. But then there were those few people that would just kind of drink every day and throughout class and when they got home. And I don't know if that was necessarily triggered by the fact that it's, you know, just a big drinking scene, or if it's more like individually, you know, if you're depressed or unstable or, you know, things like that. So I don't know what the prevalence is.
There are people who are alcohol dependent in college. And one of the universities have had some success with alcohol screening, early alcohol screening, to find students who have problems, who aren't just heavy partiers. They're alcohol dependent, and it's sort of taking over their lives. So it's hard, though, to identify problem drinkers in college, because one of the ways traditionally that we've measured alcohol dependence is, does it affect your life? Does it affect your social, your relationships, your family relationship, your work, and all that? And related to what, you know, Chris, what you said before about all this free time in their hand and the lack of social obligations, you could drink heavily and it won't appear that you have a problem because you're not letting people down or you're not failing to meet your social role obligations. So it's kind of hard to identify problem drinkers in college, but they are there, and we do know that heavy drinkers in college have a higher probability of being alcohol dependent later in life as well.
Yeah, it is remarkable, though, if you say that 45% of college students have a tendency to binge drink, at least on occasion. We know that nowhere near that percentage of them go on to become adult alcoholics. Is that because for most, or for a significant percentage, real life makes it impossible to continue this behavior?
Yeah, that's my guess, and based on the data. You know, the arc or the if you follow college drinkers and their drinking behavior, they come in with some experience. They drink very heavily the first couple years of college, and then that starts to taper off. And then when they leave college, it tapers off more as they start to accept these social role obligations, you know, parent, career employee, that kind of thing. So, yeah, I think, you know, life gets in the way, in a good way, of their drinking, and obligations get in the way.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time on the line, we have Amy in Fort Worth. Hello, Amy.
Hi. Good topic today.
Thanks.
Kind of question for your guest. He referenced earlier about the collective the next morning with the hangovers, and everyone's like, oh, you know, that was cool. It's fun. Oh, we're all sick. But what about when good times go bad and someone gets arrested for doing something foolish, be it public drunkenness or, you know, damaging property or worse, a DUI? What's the collective thought the next morning? Did you run into any of that? And I'll take my answer off air. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, I did. I'd say the typical response, and I refer to these things as, and I think I already said, as a drinking crisis. A drinking crisis is the things that go wrong, whether it's being hungover, sick, or getting arrested and all that. The typical response to a drinking crisis is support.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, positive appraisals. You were funny. Don't worry. You were funny last night. I know you hooked up last night, and I know you wouldn't normally do that. You were drunk. It's okay. And the same thing with, you know, maybe getting arrested. Generally speaking, the appraisals are positive. As far as a DUI, getting, you know, driving while intoxicated, I don't remember that in the data, how people responded to their friends getting DWIs. But if, you know, this is part of the problem. If they're unconditionally supporting each other for that kind of behavior, it facilitates that behavior. I hope people say, you got caught drunk driving last night. That was stupid. Don't do that. You know, don't do that again. But
how much forethought do they give to getting home safely?
Another good and empirical question. How much? Some, I know a lot of my respondents talk about this. They have a plan, and some of them have sort of a designated sober person,
mm-hmm,
that hangs out with them, and then some of them have designated drivers, which is a good idea. I know that many of the students that I talk to walk each other home and will never let one of their friends walk home very intoxicated, especially a female friend.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of escorting going on, and they can keep track of each other. You know, this is different from when you and I were in college. They can keep track of each other with the cell phone,
mm-hmm,
texting each other. Where are you? There's constant, you know, connections in that way. So yeah, I think they do. I think they do. There is some planning.
Do you think that you mentioned that it doesn't really help for universities to have sort of abstinence-only education or policies? Is it controversial, though, to say, look, we're aware you're probably going to drink, and here's how to do it safely? Do too many adults who are separated from the social realities of being in college by a couple of decades feel like that's tacit permission?
Yeah, I do think it's controversial, and somebody might redefine or label harm reduction approaches as enabling.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that we can and should take a harm reduction approach to risky drinking in college. But I think that should be connected with or used alongside other kinds of prevention approaches. So educating them, for me, ideally, nobody's getting dangerously intoxicated, and we're doing what we can to teach them how to keep your blood alcohol concentration at a low level. We're teaching them to not ingest dangerous amounts of alcohol. But we also, I think, need to educate people to look out for one another and do what they can to prevent crimes that are related to heavy drinking, like sexual victimization, and help, you know, and if somebody's dangerously intoxicated, teaching them to respond to that. So I think a harm reduction approach only would be extremely controversial, but I think it should just be used alongside the other kinds of prevention efforts.
We have time to take one more call. Let's go to Al in Fort Worth. Hi, Al.
Hi. I was wondering what the guests thought about talking to students younger than college. I mean, I know a lot of kids that are drinking in college also have the same experience in high school and possibly even middle school. Is this something as a society we need to address younger?
Yeah. Well, I think so. And I do think we need to address this at an earlier age. You know, we have things like DARE in elementary school. I think that may be too young. Talking to them, you know, maybe in high school, I mean, some of these harm reduction approaches maybe, too, could be applied to high school kids, that we don't want them to drink heavily, and we want to teach them to exert, peer influence, that they shouldn't drink too much and they shouldn't get dangerously intoxicated. But yeah, even adolescents could learn to know the danger signs and the warning signs and what they can do to help their friends out in these situations. So yeah, it could be delivered at a younger age.
From a sociological perspective, do the moderate drinkers who might drink a bit but don't typically engage in binge drinking, do they have more in common with the abstainers or with the bingers?
I would say they probably have more in common with the heavier drinkers.
Uh-huh.
I'd say the moderate drinkers, in terms of being more social and more open to that scene, they probably have, yeah, more in common with them than the abstainers.
Is there any evidence that some drinking behavior in college boils down to which dorm you end up being assigned to and which roommate you have, and the really close influence of those you meet when you first arrive?
Yes, those things matter. For some people who just, it's just happenstance who you end up rooming with and who you end up hanging out with, those things matter. But again, I think you arrive at school with a lot of predispositions and ideas about who you are and who you get along with. You know, we have substance-free housing, most campuses. I shouldn't say most. Many, many campuses have substance-free housing, and for students who are abstainers coming in and don't want to be part of that scene, that's a good choice for them. So in that sense, I think where you live really matters.
Thomas Van Der Ven is Associate Professor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at Ohio University. His new book is called Getting Wasted: Why College Students Drink Too Much and Party So Hard. Tom, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Great. Thanks for having me on the show.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.